Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Well, thank you for tuning in to another episode of 3GT, that is Three Guys Theologizing. My name is Kyle Borg, and I am broadcasting out of my small corner of the world in Winchester, Kansas. And today I am joined with my regular co-host, Barry York, in Beaver, Pennsylvania. Barry, of course, is our presidential presence on 3GT. Unfortunately, today we are lacking our prosecutor slash our What do we decide to call him? Kind of a pew filler, but actually our parishioner, Scott Hunt. Placeholder. That was the other P I was thinking of. Scott is not with us today. He is currently traveling home from a family vacation. And despite trying to twist his arm as much as we could not convince him to hit record while he was driving. But in his absence, we are joined by somebody who has joined us in the past, but we are excited to welcome him back. We welcome to our program today, Nathan Eshelman. So Nate is the pastor of the Orlando Reformed Presbyterian Church in Orlando, Florida. Nate, I just, out of curiosity, you've been there now for 2 years. Right. Did your call package include like any Disney benefits?
It did not include Disney benefits, but I have been to the Magic Kingdom once and Epcot once since we lived here. You know, my former charge was in Los Angeles, and the original Disney was about an hour down the road, as they say, and never went to Disney once in 12 years. And here in Orlando, I've gone twice, but I've spent a total of $100 on both of those trips. So
the enthusiasm with which you said that makes me think that the Magic Kingdom really is the most magical place on earth.
Super magical.
Sounds like it. Well, Nathan, we want to thank you for joining us today. And we are bringing Nathan on to today's episode of Three Guys Theologizing, not for his pastoral work or his love for all things Disney, but it is because Nathan has recently written a book, I Have a Confession. A number of episodes ago, Barry and Scott were kind enough to interview me about a book that I had written, a book for a new imprint called Grass Market Press. And Nathan is the other author of the first two books that were released for Grass Market Press. And his book is titled, I Have a Confession. And so we are bringing Nathan onto the program today to talk about all things relative to his book. But maybe before we get into that, Nathan, I know that you have been on Three Guys Theologizing in the past, but why don't you just introduce yourself a little bit to us again and to our listeners?
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. Thanks, Barry, for having me. It's fun to be here with you guys. It's always a nice conversation. You mentioned that I was on here previously. We talked about William Perkins and his doctrine of moderation, biblical moderation. So a little bit of background. I became a Christian my senior year of high school. Grew up in a small town in western Pennsylvania called Cory. It's in Erie County. And when it was time to go to college, I eventually ended up at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then stayed in Grand Rapids, helped plant a Reformed Presbyterian church there, went to seminary, met my wife, started a family, bought my first home. So Grand Rapids was really the starting point for being Reformed Presbyterian. And then from out of seminary, went to Los Angeles, spent a little over 12 years there pastoring a congregation in LA, and then have been here for the last 2 years.
So you mentioned growing up in Cory, Pennsylvania. I don't know a lot about Cory, Pennsylvania, other than that is not a home to a Reformed Presbyterian church. So you are a pastor in the RPCNA. As you already noted, you helped plant a RP congregation in Grand Rapids. Can you just give us a little bit of your church background? How did you come into a Presbyterian context? And the reason I'm asking that is because that's going to factor into some of what we talk about today with your book.
Yeah, pretty nosy. But anyways, so I grew up in United Methodist Church. Now, in the United Methodist Church, there's various forms of United Methodism. The church I grew up in days past was a United Brethren Church. So it had a sort of a German pietistic feel rather than a Anglicans that can't read feel. And so grew up in that version of United Methodism, and eventually, as I said, became a Christian, was converted through a conversation or a series of conversations with a woman about the scriptures and how various pieces of art from art history tell biblical stories, and then how that relates to Christ. And from there, you know, really early on in my Christian life, introduced to the Shorter Catechism. The first book I read as a Christian was Thomas Watson's Heaven Taken by Storm. You know, just really, really introduced to Puritanism. And the idea of Puritan worship was something that was discussed early on. And the Reformed Presbyterian Church is sort of a historical footnote within discussions of Puritan worship, because RPs worship like Puritans worship. So we're sort of the last holdout in some ways of that style of worship.
I didn't realize how much of twinsies we really are, Nathan. The first Puritan book I ever read was Heaven Taken by Storm.
Oh, so look at that. That's great, Kyle.
I knew we had a connection from the moment we met. So
yep.
Still remember the day we met. It was at a picnic. So
yeah, I remember that too, Kyle. Cue the music in the background while we reminisce.
That's right. Barry, you're not feeling uncomfortable, are you?
So. Did you bring your violin, Barry?
Just watching.
Well, thank you for that, Nathan. Some of that's probably going to factor into, like I said, some of what we talk about with regard to your book. So let's get in and start turning the pages.
All right.
You wrote a book, and as I've noted, its title is I Have a Confession. Which might sound like Nathan's about to reveal some deep, dark secrets, but thankfully, Nathan did not do that for the world to tune into. But it is titled, I Have a Confession, and the subtitle, The What and Why of the Westminster Confession of Faith. So could you, as we think about this is the book you've written, can you develop a little more for our listeners? What is a confession of faith, which is really what this book is about?
Yeah. So, you know, the idea of I have a confession shows some ownership there, right? It's here's something that the church confesses. A confession of faith is just that. Here's what the church confesses to believe concerning certain heads of doctrine. And the people of God are to take ownership of that. And, you know, as far as it's biblical, and to hold on to that confession. So part of the work of the church in our worship is confessing truth. And when we confess truth, we should be able to know as well as proclaim what that truth is concerning, you know, various things. What does the church believe concerning God? What does the church believe concerning man? What does the church believe concerning the person of Christ and salvation, and what is the church? And all of these things are things that the church confesses. And a confession of faith is the honest work of writing those things down for the world to see and for Christians to take ownership of.
I might just add that I really like the title. It's a really good title. I have a confession. It's kind of fun to just go around your house, and I say that to Miriam, I have a confession. And she says, what? And I hold your book up. Or I say, well, of course, the Westminster Confession, or
right,
you know. So it's a fun title.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun title too, and you know, it is fun and it's playful, but at the same time, it does show that ownership that we should have as we hold to the confession of faith. You know, there's some churches that they have confessions of faith, but they're sort of, you know, in the dusty closet somewhere, and nobody really knows what they say or what's in them. But when you take ownership of something, you say, this is mine. And, you know, we proclaim that.
You know,
it's a lively title. You know, instead of using like a 90s song for your title,
that's
of your
right.
book, it's,
yeah.
It's so lively.
Thank you. I'm. It's a good thing that this is only a podcast because I would be blushing right now if people could see. But we're not, Barry, we're not here to talk about my book, okay? I'm not about this shameless self-promotion.
Oh, yeah.
We're here to promote Nathan, the Reverend Dr. Nathan Eshelman. So, Nate, if I just want to develop this a little bit more. You talk about a confession being those things that the church confesses to be true, that the church has a role to confess the truth. Yes and amen to that. What might differ between what you're speaking of here and, you know, if I go to almost any church website and I go to their about tab and I can find a statement of faith, kind of I grew up in the Evangelical Free Church of America, and the E-Free Church has 10 points of doctrine, which until just a few years ago, the 10th point was always the premillennial kingdom of Jesus Christ, which I thought
they got rid of that,
of
right?
All the doctrinal points that need to be in the statement of faith, the premillennial kingdom made it. But what is a little bit of the difference in character between what you're talking about here, a confession of faith, and maybe just the statements of faith that almost every church has?
Yeah. Well, in one sense, the statements of faith, like you might find on a church website or on the back of a bulletin or something, are things that churches do believe. But a confession of faith is something that, number one, is more full than a statement of faith. You know, take any given chapter, except maybe of Christian liberty or of adoption, and they're going to be longer than whole church's statements of faith, you know, any chapter from the confession. So that's one thing. They're more full doctrines. They're rooted in historic Christianity. So there's a lot of connections between both what the scriptures say, as well as quotes that are pulled right from church history, you know, showing other debates that have happened in church history. But I think this is probably the most important thing. A church, like a church website statement or something, maybe something that's approved by, say, a board of a church that's, you know, 5 to 10 men or something. But a confession of faith is something that is held by synods and general assemblies and national churches and denominations. You know, you can think of all the churches, the different denominations around the world that hold to the Westminster Confession of Faith. And of all of those churches saying, this is what we believe together, having a voice of proclamation for Jesus Christ, saying these are things worth standing on. That's much different than, you know, say, like I said, 5 to 10 guys coming up with some ideas of what they believe and putting it on their website.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I appreciate that from many aspects. You know, I appreciate that from the historical continuity, as you brought up. You know, you think about, and we'll get more into this when we speak about the Westminster Confession, but the Westminster Confession was written in the mid 17th century. And it has been centuries where the church and churches have confessed the contents of that confession. And that gives a certain historical continuity. But I think it's really important in today's world, historical as these things can be, and you've already been alluding to this, but let's flesh this out a little bit more. It's not just a matter of historical continuity, or it's certainly not pragmatic. We don't believe that's why churches should have a confession of faith. We believe that this is grounded in the scriptures, that the scriptures actually give warrant, if not even stronger than warrant. The scriptures give commands that we actually do a confession, that we as a church do that. Could you develop that a little bit in a context and in a culture and society where you often hear people say, well, it's my Bible and me, like no creed but Christ.
Right.
Help us in a simple way to just appreciate the Bible's teaching on confessions of faith.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question, Kyle, and one that I think a lot of people ask when talking about confessions, because, you know, as confessional Christians, what we're really trying to do is say, look to the Word of God, look to the scriptures, go to the Bible. And then, you know, from the same side, we're saying the Westminster says, and I think that can confuse people sometimes. But what we're trying to say, and what we do say, is that the scriptures do tell us to write these summaries of what the church believes. And there are some examples you can think of in the Old Testament. There's the great Shema, that is a creed or a statement of faith as to what the church believes. And, you know, that's something that, you know, Jews today even proclaim, you know, that they believe that the Lord our God is one. We see it in places, even like the Trinitarian formula for baptism, you know, the idea of being baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And that becomes something that becomes in the early church as a way that the way we think about God is divided in theology. But even within the New Testament, there are several things that I think are helpful. And I talk about these in one of my chapters called The Permission to Write Confessions. And, you know, you think about Jude 3, talking about contending for the faith, or the idea of holding fast to the traditions of the Word of God. What are those traditions? And then if we're holding fast to those traditions, there are things that we're to codify and things that we're to promote. And then I spent some time on the Apostle Paul's trustworthy sayings as well. And in discussing the trustworthy sayings of the Apostle Paul, what we really find is him making pithy statements about theology that really help us to understand certain aspects of theology. So he starts with these faithful sayings, and then they give us heads of theology that we can start thinking under and categorizing truths of Scripture under. Now, again, when we talk about these things and how the New Testament is sort of pushing us in that direction to be writing what we believe down and categorizing what we believe and contending for what we believe, we have to be reminded always, like Francis Turretin, who you know, Barry's done a lot of work with Turretin on his views of the marks of the church. So we'll promote Barry's book too. Confessions don't have the same weight that the Scriptures do, but they are useful and helpful for the church, and they're also something that the New Testament moves us towards in developing, so that the church can say, this is what I believe. This is what I'm contending for. These are the things that are faithful. This is what the traditions of the Scriptures are. And I think that when we look at all of those things that we find in the New Testament, there really is a promotion of that idea that we should be writing confessions within the Scriptures.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. Or Barry, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I really appreciate that, because I think you're showing that confessions aren't apart from the Bible, but arise out of the Scriptures, and even the Scriptures are encouraging that. I think this comes into play in another place that we see, I think, some confusion at times. Like if you take Colossians 1:15-20, where it has that incredible, glorious statement of Christ and all of his different titles and mm-hmm. positions of authority that he has. And a lot of the modern church has looked at that and tries to use that as evidence of early hymnody. And I just say, you know, no, that's a confession. It's a beautiful confession. And it is almost poetic in nature. And I would liken it to, that's because we have different kinds of confessions. The Westminster's more doctrinal, crystalline in its statements, and then you get something like the Heidelberg, the Belgic Confession. They're more devotional in language, and yet they're both confessions.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the Colossian statement, you know, you do have the idea that a lot of people will say, oh, that's an early hymn. There's no evidence of that at all, but there's mm-hmm. definitely evidence that these theological truths were, you know, blossomed into confessional statements within the early church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know we're interviewing you, Nathan, but I appreciate as well so much of what you're saying. You know, I remember you referenced Jude 3, to contend earnestly for the faith once and for all delivered to the saints. And it's interesting, right? Faith there is not the subjective act of believing. It's the content of faith. It's the statement of doctrine. And it's interesting because Jude, how does he put it? I don't have it in front of me, but, you know, I wanted to write to you about our common salvation, but I found it necessary to write to you concerning this, that you need to contend for the faith because these false teachers have crept in. And I think, too, together with the passages that you've been talking about, the church is the pillar and the buttress of the truth.
Yeah.
And part of being the pillar and the buttress of the truth, we publish the truth, but we also stand against error.
Right.
And confessions take, I mean, you agree, right? Confessions testify against error as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see that within, you know, the whole lineage of confessional Christianity. You know, the idea of anathemas historically were something that were recorded within confessional statements. I think by the time of Westminster, they're a little tired of anathemas, and there's only one anathema in all of the Westminster Confession, you know, but ones previous to that, those the damning of false teachings were things that were done frequently, but the Westminster's focus is really on the positive teaching of scriptures. This is what we believe concerning all these things. And it's, you know, it is academic, it is full in its teaching, but that is a part of contending for the faith, is that we should have confessional statements, and we should be able to say to neighbors and friends that come into our church and they say, well, what do you believe concerning this? And you can say, in all honesty, it's written down right here. This is what we believe. And it's safe and honest. You know, we're not pulling wool over anybody's eyes. It's all there for people to see.
Yeah. No, I remember. So again, this isn't about me, but I remember the first time I stepped foot in a Presbyterian church, I came from a context where if somebody were to ask, you know, what does your church believe in the evangelical free church I grew up in, right? Free being we're free. And we were always told, well, the church believes whatever the pastor believes. And it was like, yeah, but what about when a new pastor comes in? Well, when the new pastor comes in, then the church now believes whatever it is that he's teaching. And that's what we do. And I remember stepping foot in a Presbyterian church clueless. And I was like, I asked the pastor, you know, what do you believe? And he hands me the Westminster Confession. And he's like,
yeah,
here's what we believe. And I was just, I went cross-eyed. I was like, I can't believe that something like this exists. So
let's
talk about that a little bit. In particular, your book is not just about confessions of faith in general, but the confession that you have, the confession that Barry and I hold to, our denomination, the Westminster Confession of Faith. Now, you're kind of a podcasting expert on the Westminster Confession as the esteemed host of that great podcast, The Jerusalem Chamber.
It does get plugged in the book.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Shameless. I love it.
Right.
As well as on 3GT.
Yeah, there you go.
On the best podcast, 3GT. So could you give a little more explanation for our listeners about your particular confession, the Westminster Confession of Faith? What are, Barry brought up some of its kind of some ways that people kind of treat it as a, kind of its hallmarks. But for you, what do you think of? What are parts of that confession that you in particular really appreciate?
Yeah, no, I think that's a helpful question, Kyle. And, you know, part of that answer for me is that, you know, I'm kind of a church history nerd. I love church history. And part of what I wanted to do in the book is to tell the story, at least in a sort of bullet point form, tell the story about how during a civil war in England, the pastors and theologians said, I think it'd be a good idea if we rewrote our confession of faith. You know, it doesn't seem to be the most logical jump during a time of civil war, but that is what the church did. So I told the story of that and how the confession is really connected to the political milieu of the time and the way that they called in by covenant. They called in the Scottish church and to help them with that. And it's really the best of the theologians of both Scotland and England that are sitting together in discussion of these theological truths. And then there's also a part where I give sort of a bird's eye or a drone's eye view of what the Confession of Faith teaches so that people can see the big picture. You know, it's not a commentary on the Confession of Faith, but it's a sort of a big picture idea of what the Confession of Faith teaches. And what I love about the Westminster Confession, and some people don't love this, but I do, is that it really helps us to understand what it means to live as a Christian in God's world, what it means to be a Christian, you know, how are we converted, what it means to live as a Christian in the church, what it means to live as a Christian in family, and what it means to live as a Christian in society, or specifically a Christian society, because that's the context in which it's written. So I think that when you think about that as a big picture idea of what the Confession of Faith does, it really is helpful in building a framework for what it means to be a Christian in this world. And, you know, a lot of people really struggle with that. You know, they want to know what it means to be a Christian. You know, how do I get saved? Well, of course, the confession is going to talk about what it means to be a Christian and what it means to be saved. But it also goes beyond that in the sense that it helps us to understand what it means to live Christianly in these various spheres or contexts or orders or, you know, whatever word isn't going to trigger you because you're Kyperian or not Kyperian or mediatorial kingship or two kingdoms or whatever the word is, it's not going to trigger you. How do we live as a Christian in these areas of life?
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's especially true, not to contradict you, but when you rightly hold the Westminster Confession of Faith, especially with the larger and shorter catechisms, you have a very rich piety that comes out of that into every area of life.
Would you think you think you're disagreeing with me?
No, I know. Okay. We're twinsies.
You said not to contradict as if I were against the
larger. I didn't
want to
act like I was improving upon it or anything. I know you're thinking it. I'm just giving voice to what you're thinking. Okay. We're twinsies. So
I appreciate that, Kyle.
I feel that whatever I say is whatever you say.
Yeah. So, yeah.
You know, and I think too, as you were saying, right, how stabilizing that is in our own time. You know, that's one of the things I love about the Westminster Confession. There are all kinds of questions. What does it mean to be a Christian? How do we do that? You know, we look at our changing world and our changing society. And I think the stability that this gives to be like, look, you guys, we do what we've always done as Christians. And here it is. So I've appreciated that.
Yeah. And part of the book starts out that way in saying, you know, it sort of starts by telling the story about a friend and I going out for coffee, and he's telling me how, you know, he just can't find a church that he's looking for, and sort of explaining what he's looking for. It's like, those churches exist. You're looking for a confessional church, one that's honest about what it believes, one that's vibrant in its theology, and, you know, honest about that promotion of truth.
Yeah. Barry, what do you think?
Well, I just wanted, a lot of times when people in the church, especially in the evangelical world, think about confessions, they do think about dry documents, historic documents. And one of the things I really appreciate about Nathan's book, it's written in a way that makes the confession very approachable. And it puts a, like, as you read the book, it puts a desire to go and read the confession. And often I'm encouraging not just seminarians, although sometimes we have to do that as well, but people in the church, you know, have you read our confession? Do you know what our confession is? And some of my favorite classes have been through my pastoral ministry, is teaching through the confession or having a catechism class where you're working on memorizing the shorter catechism, because these documents, though they are historic, though the language is a bit dated, I love memorizing, encouraging memorizing the catechism in the original language, because it makes you think. I'm not necessarily saying that's what we should do with our Bibles, but with the catechism, I think it's good. It reminds you, here's a historic document that our forefathers in the faith have handed down, like Nathan is saying to us. It wasn't just a few men, it's a whole assembly, national assembly that was called. And so there's just such a richness to it. And as you're saying, Nathan, there's just so much practicality for the Christian life in all these different realms. And so I do commend the book to our listeners, because I think they will find it making them thankful that we have a confession. We should be so grateful that this has been handed down to us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really a great tradition to be in, you know, to have a confession. And I think a lot of people take it for granted. They either don't care, like you said, how many have not read it. And, you know, others that don't care. There might be some that are even hostile to it. You know, we have the Bible. Why are we hearing about the Westminster? I really wanted people to see the beauty of it and to appreciate it and to help others to appreciate it too, because we are going into a rocky time for the church. And I believe that what we need is the honesty of what it means to be confessional before us to help us through that rocky time. And, you know, just there's a lot of honesty in holding to a confession that's not there when we don't.
Nathan, you know, Barry started to go here, and this is kind of where I want to bring us here at the end of our conversation. You know, we've been talking about the Westminster Confession. You've been talking about some of the aspects of society and culture that were going on during the writing of this confession, talking about the Westminster, Heidelberg, things like that. But one of the things that Barry emphasized is, and he read it, not only did Barry read it, those of you who pick up Nathan's book, I Have a Confession, can turn to the very first page. And on the back of the first page, Barry did not make it onto the front page of endorsements. Oh, I just want everybody to know that, but he made it on the back page of the endorsements. Barry endorsed it. So you will find Barry's name in that book. But, you know, one of the things Barry said is he found it to be accessible. So could you talk a little bit about that? I know that was very intentional. Who are you aiming this book at? Who do you want to encourage to pick up and read this book?
Yeah, the aim of the whole of the Grass Market Press imprint of Crown and Covenant, which Kyle's written for it. And I know, Barry, you're working on a book for the imprint as well. And I have book number two in the works for the imprint. Daniel Howe has one coming out on the Lord's Day in May. But the whole point of it is that there would be books that are rich theologically as well as practically, and yet are able to be picked up by men, especially that don't read and or that don't take the time to read a book, and can sit down and interact with the depth of theological truth, but not be scared away by a tome that is inaccessible to them. So this book is, you know, just under 150 pages. It's written in such a way that that it moves the reader along in the argument of why we should and toward what it means to have confessions and description of the Westminster Confession. And the hope is that basically anyone that can read and think is going to be able to pick it up and benefit from it.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. You know, one of the things I want to conclude with is, you know, you've been emphasizing that there's rocky times ahead for the church, and that something like a confession is going to be helpful. One of the things we've talked about in this episode is just how honest a confession is. This is what we believe. I am continually, you know, astounded that statistically speaking, in as much as you can trust statistics, people are looking for churches with doctrinal commitments.
Yeah.
What, you know, one of the best ways to kill a church is to actually abandon doctrinal conviction. And it's interesting, you know, Nathan, I know you've got a heart for rural, small areas, kind of some of the more destitute flyover areas of the United States. I've got a heart for that. And again, research is showing people are looking for churches in these areas that have a doctrinal backbone, whether or not they agree with every jot and tittle,
right?
They don't want spineless churches. They want churches that are grounded in solid doctrine. And I think as the church approaches that rocky time, you know, I'm not going to say that the Lord's going to open the doors and there's going to be mass revival in confessional churches, but I think it is confessional churches that are going to weather the storm that we're in and we're going to continue to be in. So,
yeah, I 100% agree with that, Kyle.
Well, that's great. Any closing thoughts from you, Nathan? Any final sales pitch about your book, I Have a Confession, the what and why of the Westminster Confession of Faith?
Kyle, I'm just a lowly preacher here in the southeast of the United States. I'm not a book salesman. I'm not a man with words. I'm not a wordsmith. I'm not a man looking to earn a buck. I just want the truth within this book to go forth. So if that's going to be best served by people buying thousands of copies and giving them out, then so be it.
Thank you, Nathan.
I think you just proved to the contrary.
That was amazing. That couldn't have gone better. So, but truly, we are really appreciative of this book, Nathan. We thank you for the labor of love. We know this is a topic that is very near and dear to your heart. You have also proven yourself to not only be a moderate, but to be a pastor. And this book comes from a very pastoral perspective, seeking to help people understand confessional churches and just the spiritual good that these things do. And you have truly done a service to the church, and we thank you for that. And look forward to your future work with Grass Market Press and other titles. To our listeners, we want to give you an opportunity to get a free copy of Nathan's book, I Have a Confession. We've got one to give away from our good friends over at Crown and Covenant Publications. Here's what we are going to do. If you would like a free copy of this book, I want you to be the first person. Here's what you need to do. There's just a minor set of rules. You need to go to Google and you need to type in the words Bishop George Horn. You need to get a screen capture or save the picture of George Horn. And you need to be the first person to email that to 3gt.xyz.com. And you will, we will send you a free copy of Nathan's book. Now, the humor behind this is, I know it's a podcast, you can't see his face, but George Horn, the great Anglican bishop, is Nathan's historical doppelganger. And I think, I don't know if I pronounced that word correctly.
You did. But you did.
There is an uncanny resemblance. And so be the first to send us a picture of the Bishop George Horn, and we will send you a copy of I Have a Confession. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Three Guys Theologizing. If you have not, head over to Apple Podcasts to subscribe to this podcast so that you never miss an episode, and visit us at 3gt.xyz.